Life can always use more Cedar Point. And right now, you can get more Cedar Point for less with the Fun Day Bundle for just $74.99. Each bundle gets you admission, parking, and all-day dining for one low price. That means more coasters like Steel Vengeance and more nostalgic fun in the boardwalk area. But you better hurry because this bundle won't last. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got!
Listen.
Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. And joining me today for the 117th minute of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus is, well, number one, before I introduce you to this great person, I'll say that their best film of 2015 was Magic Mike XXL, which I think may be my best film of 2015 upon reflection. Is the editor-at-large of probably one of the best emerging publications about film online, Bright Wall Dark Room, and you know, is one of the big parts of the creative core of that group, including the great Brianna Ashby, who is the artist extraordinaire over there. And she also wrote this line in an absolutely excellent, if you haven't had a chance to read it yet, I'm going to post it as a link in the One Heat Minute post, so you can check this out, but an excellent piece on death in the work of Tom Cruise, and also Free Solo. She said, just in parentheses, it's kind of just a, like an aside, let me tell you a non-secret. Men are insane. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome the editor-at-large of Bright Wall Dark Room and also a music columnist for WXR, Fran Hoffner. Welcome to One Heat Minute.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be contextualized by people knowing I think men are insane.
Well, I just love that line in amongst this great analysis of you know, Alex Honnold, who's the, you know, the subject of Free Solo. I had that same thought many times watching the film, this guy's insane. And it was just really nice reading your piece on those two guys going, no, Tom Cruise might be insane too. Like, they're insane. There's something that's beyond the realm of how normal people should be acting that takes you, you know, to do free solos or to decide that for a movie you need to learn how to do a halo jump. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, it's like writing that essay specifically, I would sort of try to like break down the sort of rationality, and then I would get to a point where I'm like, oh, and they're crazy. That is also like a whole other level to it.
And look, what better with knowing that men are insane than one of the great, one of the great proponents of like men in crisis or damaged masculinity, Michael Mann, and this movie Heat that we've now 117 episodes into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was a great addition to all the different ways men are crazy.
All right, well, we're going to watch 117th minute together. Fran and I are going to watch it together now. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and unpack it, and I'm sure we have lots to say besides the insanity of men here. A great minute featuring the amazing Ashley Judd. So take a listen, guys, and we'll be back to you in a sec.
You're gone. I got to find out if our route got spilled along with every other damn thing.
Who did it?
Who wasn't there? Trejo. I'll see you at Nate's.
Yeah.
Yeah. You still want me? You come down here right now and you get me, Dominic and me. Okay?
Okay, baby. Okay. I'll be there in 2 hours, right? Okay?
All right. God damn you, Chris. God damn you.
You're on a plane for Los Angeles.
Right.
There it is.
Yep. There's our minute.
There it is. So,
where to begin?
Where do you begin? Let's start with one simple thing. Isn't it hilarious that, like, right now in this movie, 1995, Danny Trejo isn't a Trejo isn't a name that we know. So he's like, wasn't there? Trejo. So, like, when he holds on Trejo there and he's, like, staring into Val Kilmer's eyes, he's, like, clearly off the wall on some painkiller drugs. I always just have, like, a slight chuckle now, just like, God, Trejo. Like, who would have thought he would be a massive movie star later on? And it just feels really
grating.
Yeah,
and he's not really in the top billing. I was trying to remember if he's in that series of opening credits.
No, he's not.
Because I was like, oh, I'm pretty sure that's Danny Trejo, but maybe I'm going insane. Maybe that's not him. But yeah, it's very fun to think of this as like an early role for him and that he's just called Trejo.
Yeah. He was literally a guy who had just gotten out of prison. He did two movies pretty much around the same time, back to back. One was the infamous Desperado, where he plays the man with a tattoo of a lady on his chest who throws knives at Antonio Banderas in this movie. And
amazing.
And Michael Mann's like, well, just use your name. It's a cool name. He knew.
Yeah, it is a cool name. Yeah.
Michael Mann knew from way back then.
Mm-hmm.
So this is your first time seeing Heat. Let's start there before we dive into this minute.
It's my first time seeing Heat. It's going to take a lot of self-restraint, I think, not to just rewatch all of Heat tonight. It was sort of finishing it. It just felt so massive and such a detailed undertaking that I probably just don't even understand it. Not even like on the level that you do, but just in general, I feel like I need a second time to just have all of these characters wash over me. I was listening to Bilge's episode, and I'm sure on multiple episodes you talk about it maybe feeling Dickensian.
Yes.
In a sense. But I'm in a master's program right now focusing on fiction, and for the first time in like 3 or 4 years, I'm reading a 19th century novel.
Yes.
Just because, like, in my professional working life, I was sort of like, I'm done with this. I'm not in school anymore. I'm reading contemporary American fiction, and that's it. so I'm reading this George Gissing novel called New Grub Street, which I really like, but I've forgotten the way these 19th century novels will just sort of like follow characters on little errands or journeys. And in the moment, you're sort of like, I don't know how this matters, if it matters. You know, if you read like the back of New Grub Street, sort of just like the plot description, it talks about one character. The first 5 chapters are about a whole different character. So I'm happy that I was like in this mindset of like 19th century sprawling character sort of like universe, because it gave me a good entry point for this. Because I very quickly was like, got it. It's 19th century.
it's
1995.
Yeah, it's Michael Mann's sprawling Dickensian take, except it's all just updated and contemporized.
Yeah, Dickens should have gone to LA. I wonder if he would have liked it.
Would have been a novel.
Yeah, it would
especially
have been
at that time. Especially at that time.
Yeah,
he would have been shot. Let's be fair. At that time, LA was slightly more wild.
Yeah, it would not have gone well for him. But I had a great time watching it, and I do feel very just sort of overwhelmed by everything there.
Yeah, I totally agree. There are some movies that, you see different sort of critical ethos from certain people. It's like they see a film, and sometimes if they are going to file for it, whether it's if it's a review, it's okay to sort of do that first take and have that very sort of impressionistic and raw, like, this is my first feelings of this movie. And then you get other takes, and I think that that's one of the awesome things about Bright Wall, Dark Room, is that you get people who have like dived into a topic, like they've dived into a movie and they've really worn it, and mm-hmm. it might be multiple viewings, it might be 10 viewings, but it's that difference between being immersed in the world completely. And like, you sometimes read something, you're like, someone had to have seen that 10 times to get that.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I've seen it twice or 3 times and you're like, I just never even understood it. And then in this entire exercise is like, the most extreme version of that. It's like every, and trying to get those fresh and new takes from all the different great voices such as yourself who are on the show, but it's like continuing to sort of dive in and feel out and ask every question about every character. And as I think, as you're studying that 19th century literature, that's a massive part of it. It's like you're sort of diving into all that technical stuff about the why and why that, why it works so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And what Heat was also sort of a fascinating exercise in is, I don't know, I'm pretty young, I'm 27. And you know, my film education sort of like really starts in like the late aughts and everything else. I've sort of like gone back and sort of self-taught. And so you watch something like Heat and like, I have a pretty good idea of sort of like the De Niro ethos and like the Pacino ethos, but like Val Kilmer is someone who like growing up when I grew up sort of like, I don't have a big reference for, and I've had to kind of go back and self-educate.
Yes.
Sort of like, what was sort of the idea of Val Kilmer? Like my entry point was like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang maybe a couple of years ago.
Great.
And have since had, oh, which is like an amazing movie.
Amazing.
And he's so, so good. And, but I've had to, you know, like go back and teach myself.
That's like at the, like, that's at the new emergence. You hit him at his new peak. You know, you've had to go and retroactively go to the dark years and then to like when he was the hottest actor in the world. At the time he did this, he did Batman, Doors, you know, those times, and he was like the hottest guy in the world.
Yeah, and so exactly. So my like introduction is exactly that sort of like second peak. And so I'm like, okay, so this is before all that. He's still very hot. it's deconstructing that hotness. Yeah, and I think he and sort of Ashley Judd have, there's so many interesting male-female relationships in this movie and like husband-wife relationships, and theirs to me is the most compelling, I suppose.
Yeah, she's an amazing character in this movie, and she's kind
of, she's so good.
It feels like I've been on a vacation away from her because we spent so much time in incredible scenes with her and Neil. That great confrontation, the dinner scenes, and then obviously her scenes with Chris leading up to it, and being the most, you know, very complicit in her husband's work, so to speak. Like she knows what it is. But I just love now being back with her after all this is just like, you know, you had one, she's almost like to him, like you had one job, and that job was to go away and do this job and then come home and bring home the bacon. And like the chaos doesn't seem to bother her, but like you didn't come back, and that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what's so great about her character is she has no sort of delusions about either Chris's job or her affair.
Yes.
Like the affair is not meant to be the thing that like gets her out.
Absolutely not.
Of all of this, it's not like an escape tactic. She has no sort of, you know, visions of like a life away with Hank Azaria's character.
He doesn't say. I'm offended that Hank Azaria is this guy. Like he's a perfect douche to get pushed around by Vincent Hanna and like being manipulated by the cops here. It has some great moments where Michael T. Williamson puts him in his place, which is just really divine. In this movie, it's there some of the great moments, but I'm just like, how did you get Ashley Judd? She's beautiful.
Yeah.
Like she's as beautiful as anyone. She's like savvy and clever and assertive and like gorgeous. What the hell? How did that happen? Hank Azaria? Yeah. I need to know.
Very, very bizarre. This sort of like, I mean, I guess I haven't seen a ton of him in film. My reference point for him, as it is with many people, is Simpsons. But yeah, Simpsons and Birdcage is sort of what I know him from, and maybe some of his theater stuff too. But yeah, it's not that he can't be wormy. It's I'm like, oh, I don't know if I want him to be this little worm. and I think it sort of goes against, I don't know. It goes against my expectations of affair storylines.
Yeah.
To have, I don't know, two people who seem so, I don't know, disenchanted with their own affair that they're having. Like, he doesn't really want to be held accountable for it. I don't think she really does either.
And what's funny is he doesn't seem like the guy that is okay that she brings Dominic. You know what I mean? Like, he, as a character, it's not this, like, wooing love story, whatever. It's, like, nasty hotel transient. He lives out of state. You know, it's just coming in. You know, although she's making the relationship more complicated, it's not like she's... she hasn't chosen someone who just lives across this, you know, across town or something that's going to basically be a target to be killed by Neil. Like, it's a guy who's flying in and out of LA pretty frequently. So it's like, yeah, it's got this whole other layer of I'm not getting too attached to you.
Yeah. And her sort of tearful phone call with him feels a little bit like Neil's conversation with Chris of just like, got to find another out. And she similarly is like, I guess I have to find another out.
Yes.
Sorry, this is the plan B and it's the only plan B.
Yeah, like this is the absolute last resort. I actually think that Charlene is smart enough as a character and Judd's portrayal of her has that level of depth that she would have had it in the back of her mind that he's an out, but would have, as you perfectly sort of nailed their friend. It's like it's absolutely not the thing you wanted to do. And like Neil is not wanting to have to go to Trejo's house, which we sort of stumble into the final fleeting sort of seconds of his entry into Trejo's house now to sort of see if their out's blown. But like she knows, you know, with Chris being shot, she knows her out's blown. She's already assumed that it's done and she's like, all right, I've got to find another way out of this situation because the cops are coming for me.
And I think it's so crucial that we never get like any kind of like love scene between them. We sort of are introduced to this affair as he's leaving. It's like it doesn't really matter what their affair is like at all because it doesn't matter that much to the two of them.
Yes, that's a great. Yeah, it doesn't matter to them.
Yeah.
There's no.
I think a lesser director, I think, would have been like, let's just see him have sex. Why not? Like, so the audience knows. And it's just sort of like, we know if we see him leave a motel room, what is going on. And that we don't see the sex is like, that's it. It doesn't matter.
It's not important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not important to the film. What's so much more important is that Neil's the kind of guy who wants her to have sex with this other person, isn't going to show up and stop it halfway through. That's the other lesser director move is to have Neil break them up.
Mm-hmm.
But instead he's like, no, he's going to like have it out with her when she's ready to clean up and go home.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Why are you doing this? You know, he wants to have her, all of her attention. Doesn't want any of the drama. He sort of silently wants to go into that room and have it out with her behind closed doors.
Yeah, and also shows, I think, like Neil's level of respect for her and Neil's level of respect for Chris, that it would be this sort of like, why are you doing this?
Yes.
Versus just like, I don't want, just in sort of like violently stopping it. Instead, it's just sort of like, what is happening? It doesn't make a lot of sense, which is, I think, what makes it a compelling side affair.
Yes, it is very compelling. Very compelling. One thing I wanted to talk about, because we touched back on like Val Kilmer peak hotness, this movie does something better than, you know, many movies, but it really, in that frightening heist scene, when people get shot or hurt, like, I feel like in other movies, you know, sort of more disposable action fare, when someone gets like gets clipped with a bullet, it's all good. But like Chris is messed up.
Yeah.
And so
I felt certain he was dead, which I sort of never do in action movies anymore when someone, I'm just like, oh, someone can take three bullets and they'll probably be fine. Which is like, I've read, you know, enough on sort of like gun violence to be like, no, one gunshot wound like fucks you up pretty badly. And this does make the reality of gun violence, very tangible.
Yes. Like his him being there and getting shot in the, like, essentially like in the clavicle, in his collarbone.
Yeah.
Like he's fucked up and they're going to a doctor who's inexperienced with obviously wounds. They're just going to some, you know, some guy, you know, Jeremy Pip, the great Jeremy Piven, when Jeremy Piven was still losing his hair 20 years ago. But like, yeah.
Oh,
like,
is that Jeremy Piven?
The doctor is Jeremy Piven.
Oh, wow. Evanston, Illinois native, very close to where I grew up.
Oh, well, there you go. The connection.
We had to disown him in recent years, but always happy for a Chicagoan.
And look, Michael Mann, the quintessential Chicagoan, right?
I know. And that's why it's such an oversight on my part to be so sort of behind on his filmography, is because I try to root for the Chicago movies. But yeah.
Well, you had to have started with Thief, and then you can go to all the others after that.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, no. So in that scene, like, someone who's inexperienced patching up like such a gnarly wound, mm-hmm. and just doing their best to keep him alive, he's completely just out of it. He looks like a mess. He's sallow. His color's drained from his face. And that's what really strikes me in this scene, is also that he's kind of slurring and out of it, because he's just dosed. He doesn't get it. And Neil's very crisp and clear with, like, who's not here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just the way that sort of, like, you know, B action movies are right now, it's pretty clear when someone's going to live or die.
Yes.
And what I loved about this was just the uncertainty I had up until its final minutes.
Yes.
Sort of like who is and is not in danger. And I think that scene also between Neil and Chris at the hospital or at the doctor's is compelling, because I think both Neil and at least myself as a viewer is like pretty convinced that Chris could die and that would be totally plausible.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any doubt for Neil that Chris might die. So then he's like even more keen at that moment. It feels he's most vengeful. He's like, I'm going to go find out what the hell Trejo did to make this happen.
Absolutely. And I think it also, when Chris says, you know, like, he's not going without Charlene, it's like Neil is willing to give him sort of the benefit of the doubt in that case, because he's like, he's dying. I guess I got to let him believe that she can still, like, come with. I'm not going to fight him on this in this moment.
Yeah. It's like the salve that you would have to a friend who is dying. You're not going to argue with them. Okay. Yep. She can come.
Yeah.
Like, there's no arguments here. Yep. No problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're already messed up anyway. And so it's very unlikely that you're actually going to live through this.
Yeah. So you might as well believe we can still pull this off to some extent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that great. There's a lot in the sort of postscript of the heist, as we're seeing all these reaction shots and the recovery shots and the cops doing their thing. There's just it's a pretty relentless pace after this heist, because they go in first thing in the morning and then we're heading into the night, but it's the fallout is real. Like, I love that in this movie, that the fallout is real, not only in the gun violence, not only in the potential of an out, but just it's all of it together. It's like everything that's colliding here is like, this heist was gnarly and all the cops are scrambling to figure out what the hell went down. Especially because they thought they had these guys. Guys under surveillance. So the cops are scrambling to do whatever they can do. But, you know, that one step ahead is about to happen. And the whole Wangro loose end is really going to come back and bite Neil in the coming scenes, which is a whole other dimension of the movie. But it's just this...
Yeah, it truly is.
It's a whole other dimension of the movie that we're not going to touch on too much. But I'd be interested to hear what you think of Wangro, because this is the first time viewing.
Yeah. Wangro. God, what to say? I want to be like, what a truly random thing to include in this. But it doesn't not work for me. It's such an audacious detail to have a serial killer as a pretty minor side character, all things considered.
Yes.
Like, I think as someone who has seen enough action movies, I'm sort of familiar with, like, the trope of maybe the new guy in the heist team who's a little too sensitive or a little too trigger happy, who puts the job at risk. I was sort of like, okay, it's one of these. And then I think the reveal of Wayne grow as a murderer also recontextualizes that first heist where he's sort of like, this guy's fucking with me. And it's like, he wanted to kill a guy.
That I think you're so right there. That mm-hmm. part of that, he was probably, you know, there's that great, it's great in its technical, the technical thing, the subject matter is not great, which is there's that cut to a bottle top being cracked just as he's cracking a prostitute's neck. And he's sitting in the bar and he goes, I'm a cowboy. And so I think you nailed it. Is like, it does recontextualize everything that he does in the first heist, because when he says, I'm a cowboy, he's used to going in there and shooting. And mm-hmm. he goes and works with a crew whose absolute last resort is shooting. They go in clinically, they blow with a shape charge, they block the police, they're in and out in under a minute, you know, under 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want a single shot to be fired because it just means more heat for them. And so for him, he's like, oh, we're going to get out of here effortlessly. I haven't really had to do anything. I've hit like one guy and I've been scolded.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that sort of surging like desire for him to kill something means that he just makes it up in his head. And you get to see that little trance moment where he's like, you want to fuck with me? And the guy's like staring at him and he can't hear a freaking word. And I always wonder in that moment where you see the guy staring down the barrel of the camera, like it's this great moment in this authentic film where it dives into the completely subjective, like you're in Wayne Grow's head and this guy's like staring at you, like daring you to shoot him, but it's not really what's happening. It's what Wayne Grow's seeing. And you get to look inside this psychopath's head for just like a split second.
Yeah. And I just love sort of, I love the look of him.
Yes.
The look is so compelling and so messy and so grotesque in such a specific way. Yes. Like, I think it's very fitting that everyone in Neil's crew is very, like, clean cut. And I know
have I lost you, Fran?
Do a job without something going wrong, and up until, you know, it goes wrong sort of out on the street afterwards. But the whole time they're in the bank, it's absolutely perfectly choreographed.
Oh yeah.
And you can see sort of like what they expect to happen every time because they're just so good at this. And so for Wayne Grow, who's, you know, a self-proclaimed cowboy, it's all about the chaos and the taking and this sort of, I don't know. Cowboys to me are so like imperialist. So I'm just like, oh, they're just like gross imperialists. And you can just see that in sort of all his mannerisms.
Yes. And he's, you can see it in his mannerisms, and also there's a certain flash, you know, there's the flashiness, whereas mm-hmm. everything about Neil's crew is like, keep it together, you know, gray suits, overalls, masks, you know, even with Chris, tie your hair all back so that people can't see, you know, that you've got, see that you've got the long hair, or if you do have the long hair, it's all tied back. So you're all looking very pulled together, you know, Michael Torito, mm-hmm. you know, Tom Sizemore is all like, you know, very close-knit cut hair, and you get Wayne Grow and he's got this flashy, flowing sort of balding, mullety, long hair Kevin Gage and just all the tats up to his neck and everything like that. So he's got everything there, all those identifying markers that Neil definitely doesn't want to have.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of the being both balding and having a mullet is so audacious. That there has to be more beneath the surface there. I should have known way earlier on.
that should have been the trigger for someone to be as audacious to have to be balding and to have a mullet. There's more beneath the surface here.
I was like, this can't just be a 90s look that I've willfully chosen to not know about.
Now, speaking of a movie set in Chicago, so just interested because, you know, I'm a little bit older than you. I'm 33. And I similarly, probably a few years earlier, had my filmic education started because my brother worked for a DVD and video distributor in Australia. And he used to get time code video cassettes, like when he finished high school. So he finished high school in like 1992. And 1994. And he would bring home time code video cassettes of everything that came out then. So you can imagine he brought home like the entire Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, Kevin Smith, like that Miramax Hollywood era, like, and so I feel like my film education started there, and I watched everything, including, you know, it was around the time of Heat, so like you watch everything from there, and then you sort of retrofit and you come back. So I'm just curious for you, is watching something like a Chicago set movie like The Dark Knight, do you see all of the Heat comparisons to The Dark Knight, or at least Chris Nolan's fascination with it? Is that something that ever crossed your mind when you're watching it?
Absolutely, yeah. It was impossible not to watch this and be like, I have to rewatch The Dark Knight. I'm actually thinking about rewatching The Dark Knight tonight because it wears its influences so on its sleeve. I mean, even just from like the William Finkner yes. like inclusion, it feels like such a beautiful and obvious wink now to have him in that opening bank heist. And similarly, Wayne Grow, sort of the chattiness of Wayne Grow in that opening heist is so reminiscent of whatever, you know, eventually assassinated Joker henchman won't stop talking during that opening heist. It was really startling. And I had known this. I had known that Dark Knight was sort of like Nolan doing Batman if Michael Mann had done Batman, but obviously not having half of that equation, you know, like left some blankness. But even the idea of having sort of like your hero and villain constantly in conversation with each other and having some kind of mutual admiration, if not respect, for what the other is trying to do, I think really, really contextualized The Dark Knight for me. And it's like, as I get older, I feel like I see The Dark Knight as less and less of a Batman movie. It's barely a Batman movie, minus the fact that it is Batman. But like, it is this very kind of old fashioned action saga.
Absolutely.
All of these characters, you know, abstractly, I'm always like, it's Batman, it's Joker, it's Harvey Dent. But that movie, too, also has all these like weird little side plots, you know, dueling mobs, different money jobs being pulled over on everyone. It's hard not to think about Nolan and Dark Knight. And I love Nolan. I know Nolan every couple of years. We love to relitigate if Chris Nolan is good or bad, but I'm all in on Nolan. I think Nolan's great.
I'm all in too. I don't begrudge Nolan for being deeply influenced by Michael Mann and Heat. In fact, I think he's made the best Heat homage or Heat remake that could have ever been made. He made it, and it was like one of the highest grossing movies and probably one of the most popular movies ever. Like, undeniably amazing movie, universally appreciated and loved, the highest rated comic book movie across every conceivable metric, whether it's Rotten Tomatoes, you know, Metacritic, box office, whatever. You count it all, it pretty much is in the top 5 or top 10 of every one of those lists. But I think exactly for the reasons that it gets the great, having a wonderful tension between the person who's pursuing and the person who's being pursued, and this sort of mad affair that he makes really overt, but also that he fleshes out a city. You know, Gotham City feels like Chicago, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But it's like, it kind of doesn't toil too much in the in racial structures as much as class structures in his version of Gotham City. In both Batman Begins and The Dark Knight particularly. And then, like classes rife through Rises, right? It's all about it, and it's so overt in that. But it's class struggle. But it's I think he did precisely what he needed to do to make a Heat remake without making Heat. Just like Inception is like one of the best Bond movies that was never a Bond movie. Like it's the same sort of thing.
Yeah. I live in New Jersey, but just sort of like right outside of New York City. And in the last month or something, someone implied to me that Gotham is supposed to be New York, and I almost had just like a full-on meltdown as a Chicagoan and as sort of a fan of like the Nolan Batmans. I was like, Gotham is Chicago. Like, yes. It's set there. I mean, Dark Knight Rises is not set in Chicago and is also kind of all over the place, like geographically,
yes,
influence wise. But I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, Gotham is Chicago. Do not try to take this away from me. It's all we have is the one of the worst comic book cities.
Well, that's the original Gotham was, I think it was a mashup. It was like New York if it had Prague architecture. Like, pretty much, like, it was like that. That was the original thing. But I think Chicago's grown into, like, it's grown into the Batman city.
Yeah.
New York doesn't feel like a city for Batman.
Chicago just will always have that kind of 1920s, 1930s like crime history to it that I think makes it so perfect for all these, I don't know, retro-y kind of crime sagas. Like, that was like, I don't know. It's so baked into its history and its architecture,
yeah,
that it will feel that way to me forever.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, cause we're, and look, I absolutely love this digression onto Batman. So thank you, Fran, so much. But, I just wanted to say, just as an aside, but I think, yeah, like there's something about the energy of like picking a setting that like is doing something that is almost like unquantifiable for a movie. Like what Heat does with LA in the sprawl, yeah, and in all these disparate weird locations in LA that are so un-Hollywood. And then what The Dark, yes, Knight as an example does with all those things that are so quintessentially Chicago, like this baked in sort of 1920s architecture that kind of reflects that, you know, the 1930s origin of the character. It's just doing something that's adding something that
yeah,
I'm sure that Nolan and his amazing production designers and all those technical like craftspeople who would have said, we want to shoot it here because it echoes this or et cetera, that it's sort of doing all that stuff that is priceless to like a movie and helps it stand up in so many more different and implicit ways than something that's really overt. Like, so that's why I think that, you know, that's why I think, that's why I like the look of Chicago the most, you know, but,
yeah,
but when they're as Gotham City, but then they're like, oh, we need a stadium, let's shoot it in Pittsburgh. You know, yeah, oh, we need some bridges, let's shoot that bit in New York, you know?
Yeah,
you
definitely
know, it's like, we need to stitch other cities together to do what we needed to do in, what we needed would have needed in the Chicago look. And then they still look for that. They're still looking for that Chicago look everywhere.
Yeah. And I think sort of when I think about, you know, blind spots I'm trying to sort of fill in with my film background, I think even more than sort of like Michael Mann is I haven't seen a lot of LA movies.
Mm.
And I think it also, you know, I didn't go to LA for like a period of my life. I probably went for the first time seriously like 5 years ago, and I go once a year because I have friends and I have work stuff out there every now and then, but it does have this immense sprawl that only some LA movies really bake into the narrative. I was sort of bemused, yes, at how often they're in helicopters in Heat, and I'm just like, yeah, it's a huge city, and if you have to get around quickly, I think that is probably the only way to do it is to be in a helicopter.
Yeah, you're not going to want to contend with the traffic, you know, the great LA movies, and Michael Mann does another one with Collateral coming up, you know, he's driving around all night essentially in downtown. Like, there's one or two, yeah, excursions, but for the most part it's just navigating the cross-sectional map of downtown, which still takes time. It still takes a, yeah, shitload of time because it's a big, sprawling city, even though it's, you know, 40 miles. So in a helicopter, it takes 3 minutes to get from, you know, where you want to go to, you know, point A to point B. But in that, it's there's a big sprawl. In Sydney and Oz, where I am, it's a similar thing. It's like the actual distance is not far, but the way that this traffic sprawls through this town, it's like everywhere takes a long time to get to.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I just was sort of, you know, I think people, it's become kind of a joke to be like, ah, the setting is sort of an additional character in this movie, but Heat has to take place in LA. It's an LA story.
Yeah.
It's, sort of interacting with all the sides of that city that are not what people are used to seeing or want to see when they think about what's there.
Yeah, most definitely. So finally, when you're watching Heat for the first time, as we're approaching Treo, do you feel like Treo's betrayed him?
No.
Not in the slightest for me either. And I hadn't really connected that Wangro would have gotten the information from Treo at that point. Like, it's sort of those weird things where, like, you, now that I've watched this movie countless times, I don't actually even know what the count is anymore. But, like, I remember at the time, I never thought for a second that it was Treo. Like, you always have Wangro in the back of your mind, but you're like, Treo, Neil's doing the right thing. It's like, Neil's doing the right thing because he is literally going, who wasn't here? Who knew every other detail? Who knew that we were going to be in there at this time? We dumped all of the cops. Who possibly could have flipped? Who wasn't here? And so he's doing the right thing. He's going through his methodology in his head. But when you're there and it's like Wangro, I love the reaction that we don't get to see in this minute. We're going to talk more about in the coming minutes with another guest on the show. But it's like those moments of like, Wangro. And you're like, yeah, man, the guy you missed earlier in this movie with his, as you called it, with his imperialist and audacious style with the balding and the mullet is coming back to haunt you.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's because I just have this, you know, 2019 image of Danny Trejo where I'm just like, you know, I trust him. I don't think he's a hero. so I don't actually buy this. Whereas, like, at the time, I think he's maybe easier to project upon. But no, I don't really see that as much of a – I don't see the betrayal.
No, me neither. Look, Fran, I just want to say thank you so much.
Thank you for
being a part of One Heat Minute. This has been a blast. Guys, Fran Hoffner, editor at large, Brightwall Dark Room. So if you're a music fan and you want to read her music columns, it's WQXR. And if you go to her site, which I think is franhoffner.fyi, am I right?
FYI, yeah.
.fyi, which I loved. I was like, I discovered that in preparation for the show. But Brightwall Dark Room, an amazing publication. Her stuff is great. Fran, thank you for taking the time to watch Heat for the first time and then to come onto this show to talk about it.
Yes. Thank you for giving me a real excuse finally. this has been so much fun. I love Heat.
Oh, look, I can't wait. I'm going to stay in touch with Fran. And if she continues to watch Heat and go back and revisit it, I might see if I can sneak her in to one of the later episodes. There are only now, as we have 117, that means, holy dooly, there are 53 episodes to go.
Home stretch.
Absolutely the home stretch. I never thought it would come to this. So guys, thank you so much for listening to One Heat Minute. You can find Fran on Twitter. She gives phenomenal Twitter. I didn't say that in any of her introductions or her wrap-up, but phenomenal Twitter.
Thank you so much.
So follow Fran on Twitter. I'm Blake Howard. At oneheatminute.com is where you can find me. If you want to find me on Twitter, it's at BlakeIsBatman. But as always, mail at oneheatminute.com if you want to add anything. And now that it's 117th episode, I got a wonderful email. And you talked about Val Kilmer at the beginning of the show, Fran. So I'm going to actually read this email because I think that you would deeply appreciate it. So I went to sleep last night. This was not in my inbox. And this morning, it's a great story. So I'm not sure if I can say who it is exactly. So I'm just going to say Adam. Adam is a screenwriter now, but was an actor. And he sent me this note. Hey, Blake, love the podcast. Thank you very much, Adam. I'm a TV writer living in LA and have been similarly obsessed with Heat from a young age. Random story, but I used to be an actor. And I had an opportunity to be Val Kilmer's stand-in back in 2007. It was called Columbus Day. Sadly, despite an awesome script, it didn't totally come together. Anyway, I would hound him for Heat stories. And my favorite was that leading up to Heat, when he was filming Batman, Michael Mann encouraged him to carry around a loaded 38 in his pocket throughout the day to get the feel, the spirit of what it was to be a guy like Chris. And if I'm recalling correctly, it scared the hell out of the costume department on Batman when they didn't find it in and out of the wardrobe. How badass is that? Keep it up. I came to the podcast late. I'm only at episode 39. Thanks for your time, Adam. That is one of the greatest emails I've ever received in my life. Michael
Mann.
That
is real. That is like perfect men are insane canon.
So perfectly, Michael Mann is insane. Please carry around a load of 38. Poor Joel Schumacher filming Batman Forever and his costume department with their bat nipples are terrified of the gorgeous Val Kilmer rocking around with a load of 38 when he's just behind the scenes. I love this. Fran Hoffner. We told you at the beginning of the episode that she said that men were insane. That is the perfect email to end this episode. Guys, thank you so much for listening to One Heat Minute. We'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner. And if you just want to be the spirit of the person like in Michael Mann's movie, just walk around with a loaded 38. Thank you, Fran. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was so much fun.
I'm glad you're...